This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 341. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am spectacular, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. I can't wait for today's episode. I want to learn more about impeachment. And I also love that you've slotted our wild card segment that we haven't been able to get to for, a month. You've slotted that into the A segment to make sure we get to this good listener question. But before all that, a quick 35 minutes on my fantasy football berth. So there I was, one game out, because I'd had a dreadful appearance against Andrew a few weeks ago. Lost by 1.5 points. Both our teams actually just were terrible. It was like nobody scored anything. And then I thought that loss was going to cost me playoffs. One of the best teams. I'm at least in the second or third best in points. But no, everything aligned. It was all great. Okay. So, okay, chapter one. There.
No, after okay, this, I have a B segment that I keep pushing off that is on baseball law, that is on the rather ridiculous proposal by MLB to eliminate 40 minor league baseball teams. So, I can go toe-to-toe any day of the week.
Is that a threat?
in a race to the bottom to make sure we have no listeners.
All right, you've made your point. Fine. The point is I made the playoffs in the Fantasy League. Congrats, everybody. And
congrats to you.
This is the Opening Arguments Fantasy League, by the way. It's not just, not just any Fantasy League. I mean, work-related. It's work-related. All right, you've made your fine. Okay, you're right. I don't want to. This isn't sports law. We've got so much to talk about. Great listener question, as I mentioned, that we've been pushing off, but we're going to make sure we get to. And then we're going to do some updates on impeachment. And I'm curious what the process is supposed to be for the next few days. And I'm sure everybody is too. And then do we have a different wildcard segment, or we might have a segment that Andrew is going to make sure we get to about Trinity Lutheran and a new case along those lines. So looks like you have an announcement before we get started.
Yeah, well, related to that C segment, it is not going to be a wild card. It comes courtesy of a friend of the show, Andrew Seidel, and our friends at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. It involves a $10,000 scholarship to law students. So we have a lot of law students who listen, and I kind of think you'll want to listen and find out about this. So
now I think it would be even funnier if we were like, no time. Sorry.
No time. That's right.
We have these law students like sitting there with waiting to write to figure out how they're going to get $10,000.
Yeah.
We're out of time. No.
Yeah.
We'll get
they'll
to
be
it.
Like,
we'll
but thank goodness I heard about Thomas's fantasy football team. So I don't need to pay tuition next year.
Josh Allen, been a great quarterback for me all season, but
Josh
I saw that Ryan
been.
Tannehill was available. I picked him up. It made all the difference. I only won the tiebreaker by 8 points, and I gained. Okay, sorry. No, you're right. You're right. Can't do it. Never mind. Here we go. Law stuff. Here's our first segment, a listener question.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Okay, Brian Brazil asks, ooh, I wonder if he's related to Brody Brazil, Sharks commentator. Never mind. Sports. Quote, I've read arguments both that Trump could and could not plead the fifth during impeachment proceedings. On one hand, I've read that since it's an impeachment proceeding and it's not a criminal case, the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply. That was my first instinct, by the way. Much like the rules of evidence. In addition, abuse of power is not a specific crime. Therefore, it's not self-incriminating, even if the Fifth does apply. On the other hand, if what he's being impeached for is considered a crime even out of office, then maybe the Fifth Amendment would apply. Ooh, yeah, excellent points either way there. Can you plead the Fifth on impeachment? I'm genuinely unsure. Let's hear, Andrew, what is your breakdown of that?
Yeah, very straightforward answer. So this segment is going to run 20 to 30 minutes, of course. And that answer is yes, you can plead the Fifth in impeachment.
Interesting.
The latter view is what's correct. So let's kind of unpack this a little bit. I thought this was a fantastic question, and I have seen different pieces suggesting either side. And I thought Brian did a nice job of articulating the argument that the Fifth doesn't apply, which, you know, has a lot of surface level plausibility.
Yeah.
But let's delve into that. Right. So the Fifth Amendment protects you against compulsory self-incrimination, right? So it applies whenever you are called upon to testify in a legal proceeding. Okay? And so the fundamental inquiry in Fifth Amendment law is there a legal proceeding, right? And that does not have to mean you're charged with a crime. It does not have to mean that there is a that there's a pending case or anything like that. It has a specified meaning in the case law that we're going to unpack. And as a sidebar to the sidebar, the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, like virtually all of the rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, has been incorporated out to the state. Right? So it also applies in state court. And most crucially for purposes of this analysis, it applies even if, for example, the underlying lawsuit is a civil lawsuit, right? And think about that. Otherwise, it would be super easy to get around the Fifth Amendment, right? You would just sue somebody. You would say, hey, this particular proceeding is just a civil lawsuit. You don't face any criminal liability. So now you have to answer this question under penalty of perjury. You answer that question, and now you've admitted in open court something that is admissible against you in a subsequent judicial proceeding that has not yet been brought.
And one thing we've learned from the show is that one weird tricks usually, not always, usually aren't valid. Like there's usually, if there's one weird trick to get to totally make something useless or get around it, then the law is like, nah, let's not allow that, right?
Yeah, that's right. I also want to add, though, that underlying question, right, does impeachment count as a legal proceeding? It has never been answered squarely for obvious reasons. But the question of whether testifying before Congress, right, which I would say, if testifying before Congress is a legal proceeding, then testifying before Congress in impeachment is a legal proceeding, right? That right was not clearly found in the Fifth Amendment until the 1950s.
Interesting.
And we get to go back to our friend Joe McCarthy. Not
I was going
to
say, friend, is right? It, yeah, communism, like, yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it absolutely is that. It was the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or the companion Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, right? That's what heard the Army McCarthy hearings, right? They subpoenaed a whole bunch of witnesses, and those witnesses claimed the right not to answer, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And those witnesses who refused to answer those questions and asserted their Fifth Amendment rights were disparaged even in mainstream media circles as, quote, Fifth Amendment communists. They lost their jobs. They suffered other political repercussions for taking the Fifth. And so the case that established that it is permissible to take the Fifth in congressional testimony is a case called Watkins versus the United States. And right, as we said, it was an open question at the time whether you could take five in response to a congressional subpoena. And in Watkins, the Supreme Court granted cert to resolve that question. They were reviewing the conviction of a witness for contempt for declining to answer questions posed to him by the House Un-American Activities Committee. Watkins cited his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And the lower courts said no, right? The lower courts upheld his conviction for refusing to testify. And it was not until the Supreme Court overturned that conviction, plainly ruling that the Bill of Rights applies to congressional hearings just as it applies in other cases. There was a really, really good, at the time that this case was pending, there was a 1956 Law Review article that essentially said this should be a no-brainer question, and kind of called into question the trial courts that were upholding these convictions for witnesses who took five. So that's the answer to your question. Yes, Trump could plead the Fifth if he decided to show up, or if he decided to provide answers to the Senate impeachment trial. I might point out that when Trump was running for office in 2016, he, of course, tweeted out, because there's a Trump tweet for everything, yeah, you know, that when Huma Abedin refused to answer questions about a private email server, quote, the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment? But, you know, that. That, of course, applies.
I'm sure that hypocrisy will get him, and then it'll be the end of the Trump era because we found hypocrisy.
Yeah, exactly right. Who could imagine a president? Yeah, anyway. So, good question.
Let me ask you, though, does the pleading the Fifth, and I guess this would be more in general than specifically about, you know, Trump, because it sounds like the same rules apply no matter what. What are the limits of pleading the Fifth? Do you have to plead the Fifth on specific issues or questions, you know, on a case by case, question by question basis? Or if you're Trump and like, imagine, you know, people want to ask just general stuff, like even just questions leading into stuff. Can he just plead the Fifth and not say anything at all? Or does it have to be like, oh, this, it's related to specifically this question that might implicate me in a crime or something?
So really good question. And let me unpack the various answers to that. Number one, you can make an omnibus assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege, right? You can say, I'm not going to answer any of this because all of it is something that could, and the legal standard is that the witness reasonably believes could be used in a criminal prosecution or could lead to other evidence that might be so used, right? So the Fifth Amendment doesn't just protect you. Yeah, right. It doesn't just protect you from the cops, bring you in, sit you down and, you know, law and order you and are like, come on now, you know, if you tell us, then this will go a lot better. And you can assert your Fifth Amendment rights there. You can also assert your Fifth Amendment rights not to incriminate yourself by talking about stuff that could lead to the discovery of evidence that could be used to incriminate you, again, for the same sort of one weird trick reason. So you absolutely can assert Fifth Amendment privilege on an omnibus basis. The standard is really, really broad. You could also assert it on a question-by-question basis, but here's where it gets a little bit tricky. Because you can waive any and all of your rights, right? So the most obvious is you have the Miranda right to remain silent. But if you sit there, you're advised of your right to remain silent, and then you, you know, knowingly sign the paper and decide to talk to the cops anyway, don't take legal advice from a podcast, but don't do that.
You hear that? Yeah. Nobody talk to the cops, says Andrew Torres.
Talk to your lawyer first. Make an informed decision with your lawyer before you talk to somebody.
And we don't know you. We didn't do anything. We don't know you. Why are you at? No, yeah. Nobody talk.
Yeah. So you can waive your rights. And in fact, right, the easiest way, right, like the standard police procedure is to have a witness who communicates voluntarily sign a waiver, right? Because then there's that it's a strong it's easier to prove. You can't come back and go, I never told them. But there are plenty of cases that involve waiver by conduct. Right. The witness comes in, is advised that she has a right to remain silent, talks anyway. And that's a waiver of your right to remain silent. So the way in which that applies in the Fifth Amendment case is, if you answer questions on a particular subject matter positively, you can't then refuse to answer on cross-examination, right? Mm. You can't give one-sided testimony on a particular subject matter. You will be held to have waived your right to Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination with respect to that particular subject matter. Make sense?
Yeah. So don't even... Nothing. Don't even say anything, I guess.
And look, that's what Trump's going to do, right? Like, Trump is not, I know the question was floated at a time in which, Trump was trying to dominate news cycles by saying, well, you know, I might appear at the, he's not going to appear. He's not going to answer questions. He hasn't turned over a single document. He hasn't responded to any of the requests.
Yeah. And plus it's going to be like with executive privilege, you know, where. I realized just as I was asking that question, what would actually happen, if anything, would be he'd say the Fifth and just not answer a single thing. Just similar to how they've claimed executive privilege on things that have no business at all being executive privilege, like not even related, but they've decided executive privilege means nobody has to say anything ever to anybody if they've ever talked to the president. So, and that still seems to work. I don't know, the courts... Are the courts ever going to catch up with that, Andrew? Does justice ever matter?
So I think that's an outstanding transition to our main segment. How about we say that?
My name is Christopher Armitage, and I'm running for the U.S. House of Representatives from Eastern Washington State. We have the opportunity right now to have our incumbent, elitist, homophobic Republican lose. And she won't just lose. She'll be defeated by a working-class, progressive, LGBTQ Air Force veteran with a background in national security. If you donate to Armitage for Congress via Act Blue, we're able to knock on every single door in this district, and we win. My name is Christopher Armitage, and I support this message.
All right, well, here we go. Well, Brian, start your yodelers, Brian.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
So you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please. Okay.
I think, if there's ever a time to yodel, it's when discussing articles of impeachment. I wasn't sure. I'm a little fuzzy on what's happening now because I thought they were going to be out, but then I guess they're debating them. But what's that debate process? I don't know. Well, basically, I'm sure there's a ton to talk about. Ready, go.
The Judiciary Committee has drafted two articles of impeachment against Donald J. Trump, and we are going to break those down. The debate that is taking place is within the Judiciary Committee right now. literally as we record this. And depending on how Nancy Pelosi schedules votes, it could be voted out of the Judiciary Committee later today and potentially voted on by the entire House of Representatives by the time this airs. Oh, wow. And you're listening to it, if not by early next week. So we know what the Judiciary Committee is proposing as the articles of impeachment against Trump, and we're going to break that down. It has to go through that two-step process, right? It has to be voted out of the Judiciary Committee, which it will be, and then it has to be voted out of the entire House of Representatives, which it will be. There will be some interesting questions with respect to how the vote breaks down, which we'll talk about and communicate over social media and our usual spots, because this is all going to happen before we record again. We know that we are going to get the overwhelming majority of Democrats plus independent ex-Republican Justin Amash. We don't anticipate getting any other Republicans, and we don't know about a handful of very, very conservative Democrats.
Yeah.
So that's the way the vote is going to break down. And the other thing that I find interesting as we go through both of the articles is that historically, the substantive, when we look back at the votes with respect to the Clinton impeachment and the proposed Nixon articles of impeachment, which passed out of the judiciary but were never sent to a full vote to the House of Representatives because Richard Nixon resigned while the writing was on the wall. In both of those cases, there were what you might call substantive charges, right? With Clinton, it was the charge of perjury, lying in the Paula Jones lawsuit. With Richard Nixon, it was the violation of the civil rights of individuals in connection with having private White House investigations and using the power of the IRS to investigate his political enemies and that sort of thing. Those articles, the substantive articles, got a higher vote than the procedural articles, right? So both Clinton and Nixon were charged with obstruction of justice. Nixon was also charged with abuse of power. And the abuse of power article got the lowest amount of votes. Obstruction got a couple more votes. Violating constitutional rights got one more vote than that. So so I will be watching to see if there's any distinction between the vote totals on Article 1 versus Article 2.
Right. And I've also seen the idea that, like, it might be wise strategically for some of these Democrats you're talking about, some of these Democrats in either red or purple states, if Pelosi puts, or whoever, you know, I guess it would be the judiciary, if they put in a charge that's a little softer that, like, some Democrats can vote no on just to say they did. I've seen that floated as a possibility. I don't know how much I like that idea, but I guess there could be something there.
Yeah, I don't like that idea. So let me do a couple of things. I'll give you some top lines right now, and then we'll break them down. My prediction is, given the polarized nature of Trump right now, I don't think that there's a way to thread the needle. Right. I think if you're a Democratic congressman in a deeply red district, you've just got to bite the bullet. You're either going to vote to impeach Trump or you're not. Right. There's not a good way to, like, parse that. If you have pro-Trump constituents, that there's just no way to sort of part. Well, I voted against this one, right? Like that. I don't think that that's likely. My prediction record hadn't been great lately. So maybe I'm wrong on that. And then secondly, I'm not a fan of how these impeachment articles are drafted, and we'll walk through them. But I'm a little bit
interesting of these ones specifically, or you mean how in general they are written?
No, I mean the ones that have been drafted by the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is Congressman Jerry Nadler, who has drafted these proposed articles. Again, they have not been voted out of the Judiciary Committee, so it's possible that they will be amended. But, they're going to take the form that we see.
Yeah.
I also want to point out, we did a super lengthy impeachment explainer, episode 319. There's even a transcript up, so you can go back and refresh your recollection as to how the would have been Nixon impeachment and how the Clinton impeachment actually took place. So, you know, you and I did, gosh, I think it was almost a 2-hour episode on that. So I feel like that's a good resource. But I'm a little bit biased. So what are the two articles coming out? The two articles that have been drafted, Article 1 is abuse of power. And this is fundamentally my opposition to the way this has been drafted. This is drafted in such a way as to try and sidestep the arguments over bribery. But as you read the abuse of power, it is the crime of bribery. Sure. So, yeah. And I'm going to explain why they did the thing that they did, but I I'm curious if you, maybe you disagree, right? Like, maybe this is the lawyer in me feeling like you should confront the argument head on. But
all right,
the abuse of power is solely confined to Ukraine. Right. So this begins on page 2. It says, using the powers of his office, Trump solicited the interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, in the 2020 presidential election. Trump sought to pressure the government of Ukraine to take these steps by conditioning official U.S. government acts of significant value on Ukraine to Ukraine on its public announcements of investigations into the Bidens. Trump engaged in this scheme or course of conduct for corrupt purposes in pursuit of personal political benefit. In so doing, he used the powers of the presidency in a manner that compromised the national security of the U.S. and undermined the integrity of the U.S. democratic process, ignored and injured the interests of the nation. And then that's specified. It says he engaged in the scheme or course of conduct through the following means. And it repeats what I just said, right? Using both directly and with his agents, asked Ukraine to publicly announce investigations into the Bidens and CrowdStrike. 2, with the same corrupt motives, Trump, acting directly and through his agents, conditioned 2 official acts on the public announcements that he had requested. That is, the release of the aid and the face-to-face meeting. And then, faced with public revelation, he ultimately released the military and security assistance, but has persisted in openly and actively urging and soliciting Ukraine to undertake investigations for his personal political benefit. And there's other stuff around it that we can talk about, but that's the abuse of power argument, and our listeners will recognize those are the elements of bribery, right? I would much rather this be listed as bribery. I think the reason that Congressman Nadler decided not to list this as bribery was because he wanted to sidestep the argument over, and there are really two arguments, right? The argument is whether the bribery standards apply under 18 U.S.C. 201 or under common law bribery, you know, the one that's referred to with the capital B in the actual impeachment clause itself, right? And I guess to a lesser extent, the Robert Mueller argument of we don't know how valuable Oppo research is, or, you know, announcing an investigation into your opponent. Working backwards, that's a dumb argument, right? Like, Congress can just call Beth Kingsley to testify, right? Like, solicit a brief from her, right? Like, it is settled law that having the president of a foreign power announce on TV that they're opening corruption investigations into your political opponent is a thing of value, right? I would welcome that argument. And the idea that you would want to sidestep that and or sidestep the idea that maybe, because there is some merit, as we've discussed in the previous episodes, that the conditioning of the face-to-face meeting was not an official act under 18 U.S.C. 201, even though it obviously would have been bribery at common law, right? I just think the way I would have written this article is I would have said, the president of the United States has committed historic and contemporary acts of bribery, right?
Oh, really? Okay.
The kind of bribery that was conceived of by our founding fathers, put into capital letters and inserted as the primary reason for impeaching a president, right? Also, he's committed the kind of crime that gets you locked up, right?
Yeah.
But that's me.
Well, so do you, how was it done with Clinton? I mean, because part of me wonders, you know, maybe it makes sense to just describe the facts rather than try to put a name on it, because it's like, you know, is it the House's job to do that, or is it that would be more in the Senate because they're actually convicting in the Senate? I don't know. This is just off the top of my head. Could that be the reason? I mean, when those articles were written, was it Clinton committed perjury, or was it like, well, he said, you know, he told us this when he should have said this or something? How did that work back then?
Yes. The Clinton articles of impeachment provide specific instances. So in other words, and there were four proposed, only two that were voted out. Those two that were voted out were, number one, perjury, and specifically the president provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony to the grand jury regarding the Paula Jones case and his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And then Article 3 was, and also he obstructed justice in trying to cover up all of that stuff.
Okay. So it does outline the actual crimes and says all right, yeah, we should have done that.
I agree. Now look, part of the reason why we should have done that is because this first article is, by its terms, confined to the Russia-Ukraine, right, withholding of aid, right? Like, it is, and I'm previewing a bit of future questions, right? None of the other stuff that Trump has done could possibly be used as relevant evidence in support of this first article. That's not necessarily the case with the third article, which I'll talk about in a minute. But because this one is confined to its facts, I think it makes sense to call it what it actually is, which is bribery, because the Republicans are already starting with the, like, well, you haven't even specified what the crime is, right? That's an incredibly stupid argument, because this article is entitled Abuse of Power, and as we previewed, one of the three articles of impeachment that was voted out of the House committee against Richard Nixon was abuse of power, right? That was Article 3. The third article of impeachment that was voted out against Richard Nixon was also voted out for abuse of power. Now, I will tell you, delving into that, the abuse of power in the Nixon impeachment was also related to the obstruction charge, right? So, for example, that article says that that one of the ways in which President Nixon abused his power was by he has, quote, failed without lawful cause or excuse to produce papers and things as directed by authorized subpoenas and willfully disobeyed such subpoenas. Yeah, so that this will be very familiar stuff. So in other words, if you are looking at small p precedent, right, and that's what we have to go on here. We do not have case law involving impeaching a president. We have prior conduct. And if we go by prior conduct, charging a president with abuse of power and all three impeachments involve obstruction of justice, right? That so there is the abuse of power and also the obstruction of justice. These are reasons to impeach a president. So I don't think that the Republican argument, like any of the Republican arguments, is very good. But I would have preferred that first article be a charge of bribery. I am sure if I had access to the conversations between Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler that they would have some argument and probably a non-trivial, non-ridiculous one for why they did it the way they did. If I were to make a supposition, it would be that the issue that we talked about a couple of episodes ago, and that is because the law and order watching American public has an idea of what bribery is that might not necessarily match up. Maybe they were trying to, you know, change the rhetoric around it. I don't know. I've been immersed in this, and from being immersed in it, I was a little bit disappointed with how Article One was framed.
Well, it's a tough job. We've talked about this from the beginning, that I genuinely wondered whether or not they should include Russia stuff or Mueller stuff, and like that's a real decision that, like, either way, it seems like there are, you know, positives and negatives to it, because if you don't include it, then it's like, oh, was that just for nothing? Was that not really impeachable, even though we all know it was impeachable? But if you do include it, is it distracting from the Ukraine stuff, which seems to be a much easier to grasp storyline, something that everybody can maybe vote a little easier on, communicate a little easier on? So there's got to be a lot of discussion over how exactly to do this. And it's a tough job that I guess I don't envy.
Yeah, that's right. And look, there is the potential that if there is a bombshell development in connection with any of the Mueller stuff, that could come in under these articles of impeachment. This is not something I've seen anybody else point out, but it seems really, really clear to me. In both Article 1 and Article 2, although it really only makes sense in Article 2, which is the obstruction of justice, if you go to page 7, beginning at line 21, again, we'll link these in the show notes so you can do this. After describing, so obstruction of justice article is about how the White House obstructed the investigation into the bribery that is the subject of Article 1, right? And so specifically, Trump abused the powers of his high office by, one, directing the White House to defy a lawful subpoena by withholding the production of documents sought by the committees. That's true, and he did that. Two, directing other executive branch agencies to defy lawful subpoenas and withhold the production of documents and records, in response to which Department of State, OMB, Department of Energy, and Department of Defense refused to produce a single document or record. That is 100% an abuse of his executive authority, right? And then three, directing current and former executive branch officials not to cooperate and to defy subpoenas, including Mick Mulvaney and various other subordinates who were issued subpoenas, who all blanket refused to comply with those subpoenas. And then we get to this sentence, which says, these actions were consistent with President Trump's previous efforts to undermine U.S. government investigations into foreign interference in United States elections. That's it. And then, through these actions, Trump sought to arrogate to himself the right to determine the propriety, scope, and nature of an impeachment inquiry into his own conduct. That's why it's an abuse of power. That language is taken almost word for word from the third article of the Nixon abuse of power, right? So again, following precedent. But I think, right, that sentence says, hey, in telling this story, we can explain the context of this story, and we can explain the gravity of the offense by talking about Trump's previous efforts to undermine foreign interference in U.S. elections, which is everything that is contained in Volume 2 of the Mueller report. What this forecloses, in my view, is anything related to emoluments, to Trump's taxes, to other sort of mainstream corruption. And look, we may get, right, like the Supreme Court may deny cert in the Mazars case in a couple of days, right? Huh. So
then
that
all of a sudden, a whole new batch of articles of impeachment to write, huh?
That's right. I mean,
get out your quills, Nadler.
Yeah. As currently written, even if there is direct evidence of corruption by the president in his taxes, that could not come in.
Well, could not come into this specific thing, but we could do this again, right?
We could do this again.
Because I want to run this by you, because that that's been one thing I've wondered about. Like, would it have made sense to, when we talk about like what actually to include, Mueller or all that, would it have made sense to maybe phrase this in such a way that it's like, okay, there's still a lot of investigation to be done on Mueller stuff. not my exact language. I'll clean it up once I draft the actual articles, but bear with me. This isn't related to the Mueller stuff because there's still investigation to be done. By the way, the president is still, you know, withholding evidence and all that. But the Ukraine stuff, we already have all the facts from the very beginning with the phone call transcript. Like, the facts are there. This is already enough to impeach on. So this is that. But we reserve the right to, at a later date, if necessary, we're still pursuing other avenues of investigation. Like, would it have made sense to phrase it in a way that's like, okay, yes, there's all these other crimes that we, you know, could and are still in the process of investigating and could impeach him on. But impeachment is sort of like, it's not like you need a certain number of crimes to be impeached. You know, it's like he's already hit the threshold with this Ukraine stuff. So we're just going ahead on that and sort of neatly dividing it out so that you sidestep the question of, you know, whether or not to include the Russia stuff in this, in these articles. Would that have made any sense?
I think, parsed correctly, that the way you ended that is 100% how I would have drafted these articles of impeachment. So let me unpack that a little bit. But I agree with you completely. Now, the thing that you would want to avoid is you would want to say these articles are on these articles, right? But then at the end, I would want to include the standard legal waiver that says nothing in these impeachment articles is meant to exonerate or otherwise indicate that ongoing congressional investigations into Donald Trump's conduct, you know, including without limitation, right, emoluments, right, like, and list all of it and say, you know, although, you know, we're not bringing on those charges, that doesn't mean that that we're done. Right. This should not be indicated as any kind of a waiver.
Because my thinking is like, it's not as though when somebody is just a completely corrupt, you know, POS like Trump is, it's not as though you have to like wait for him to finish committing all the crimes to get him out, like leave him in office for like a year or two while he finishes doing all his crimes and you investigate them and the courts clear the different stuff you're trying to do. Like, it seems it's more like, okay, this is an emergency that this criminal is in charge. So the minute there's even one article of impeachment with enough, you know, where we've tied up all the loose ends and we've investigated enough, we start there and then reserve the right to do more later if necessary.
Yeah. I mean, if you would not have an FBI investigation that's like, well, you know, this serial killer still has some other plans in the works. Like, exactly. Let's see how those play out.
Hey, do you have any other victims coming up? Should we wait for those? We just want to make sure when we charge you with stuff, we get everything.
We're going to charge you with everything.
Yeah. Is any current plans? We'll hold off. You know, we'll wait if you're still.
So look, and the reason that I parsed it as narrowly as I did is because you don't want to hand, because it would be a break with prior precedent, right? Like, none of the previous articles of impeachment have said, by the way, there's lots more bad stuff that we're not going to talk about yet. But none of the other presidents are this bad. So, you know, that's to me, that's a reasonable failure to depart from a failure to abide by prior norms. And number two, as long as you're clear that says we are impeaching you over these specific articles, right? Because there is, even though it's only analogistically, right? Like, there is a concept of you are the defendant in a trial before the Senate, right? And so you want to make sure that your articles of impeachment hew as closely to an indictment as possible, because otherwise, you know, you're sort of handing out the argument of like, oh, well, you know, this is supposed to be a trial, but this is a farce of a trial. Like, I don't even know what I'm being accused of. But I think you could make that super clear of like, no, you're being accused of one and two. But by specifying one and two, part of what you did in two was make it impossible for us to get the information we need to charge you with 3, 4, and 5. And we think these are viable and reasonable avenues of inquiry and investigation. And we do not intend to waive our rights or otherwise, you know, weigh in on that. So I think that is brilliant, and I wish they had done that. And I
thank
wish,
you. Now
opening
that
arguments
call me.
Had been attached yeah. to the to the House Judiciary Committee. Next time, you know, we're out here. We're doing this for free, guys. You could
well, it's pretty
call.
Easy to play Thursday morning committee chair. All right, armchair committee.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite fantasy game.
Yeah.
Fantasy football is a close second.
Just armchair committee chairing over here.
So there you go. These articles are going to get voted out of the Judiciary Committee, as I said, probably by the time this show goes to press. So we will see what they look like in their final form, but I don't expect major changes. If they do, we'll cover it. We'll, you know, if it's an emergency, we'll do an emergency episode. So, you know, we'll make it happen.
All right. Well, there you have it. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Vistaprint. Hey, it's the holidays. You want to send out holiday cards. It's a nice thing to do. I love getting holiday cards with little updates from friends and family and so forth. And Lydia and I just did our little photo shoot with the kids for our holiday card. We're getting that done. We're going to do it through Vistaprint. Vistaprint is amazing. It's the best way to custom order and print a holiday card. And you want to make something good so that your friends and family will give you that key fridge real estate. You don't want to make something that doesn't look good that somebody discards. So use Vistaprint to make a truly amazing holiday card. I highly recommend it. This holiday, you can spread more joy with custom holiday cards, calendars, and photo gifts from Vistaprint. No matter where you'll be during your time off, whether it's skiing, hanging out at beaches, or settling in at home with your loved ones, nothing says happy holidays like a custom card or a calendar or photo gifts from Vistaprint. And, you know, it's a busy time. There's a lot you got to remember to do, including, you know, have fun and enjoy yourself. But it's a busy time. So Vistaprint is here to help because it doesn't really even take that much time to make an amazing card. Here's what you have to do. Pick a shape like a, you know, square or rounded corners, folded or flat, and then choose one of Vistaprint's designs. They've got everything from fun and festive to gorgeous and eye-catching looks. Next, you can put your favorite picture right there on most of the options and even upload a great shot right from your phone. Then just figure out how many you need and order them with time to spare. So what are you waiting for? They've got hundreds of card designs from timeless classics to fun new trends. Vistaprint also has custom calendars for gifts that keep giving all year round. And all custom cards and calendars are up to 50% off right now. You can also, again, upload your favorite photo right from your phone and put it on a mug or a canvas or any other photo gift. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. So this season, make more merry at Vistaprint.com with up to 50% off all holiday cards and photo calendars, plus great deals on photo gifts at Vistaprint.com. Just enter promo code OA50. That's Vistaprint.com. And remember, promo code OA50. Offer expires January 5th. That leaves us no time to talk about the $10,000 that the lost. No, just kidding. It's time for our C segment, our guaranteed, not a wild card, it's just a card. here, let me read the card. It's our next segment involving the possibility for a $10,000 scholarship for law students. So what are we talking about today? What?
Yeah, this is, I'm going to include the link in the show notes. This is the 2020 Cornelius Vanderbroek Memorial Essay Competition put on by our friends over at the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
What a name.
It is $10,000 in scholarships, right? So the first prize is $4,000, but there are multiple other prizes and all sorts of great stuff that's out there. So the essay writing topic is, are no aid clauses constitutional? And it has to do with a really critical Supreme Court case that is currently pending, for which our buddy Andrew Seidel is lead counsel for FFRF, has submitted a truly excellent amicus brief on behalf of 7 or 8 additional organizations, right? So, you know, sometimes it's our friends over at the Secular Humanist Association, right? Like FFRF is taking the lead on this one. This is a super tricky case, and it is really, really important, and we are headed towards potential disaster. So the reason I'm signal boosting this is not just because it's scholarships for law students, which, hey, if you're out there and you're at an organization and you give away scholarships to law students, shoot us an email, openarguments@gmail.com, right? Like, we have lots of law students that listen to this show, and we're happy to you know, mutually benefit everyone. This goes beyond that, right? This is not just an essay writing contest to, like, polish your writing skills. It is really, really crucial that we crowdsource and mine as much as possible the arguments in favor of the constitutionality of no aid clauses, because under the Trinity Lutheran standard, this current pending case, which is Espinosa versus Montana Department of Revenue, is going to go the other way. It may go the other way on a 7-2 ruling, and the in the same way that Trinity Lutheran was 7-2, and the implications are truly terrifying. And I say that again, you and I are both atheists. The no aid clause is in the Montana Constitution, was written in the 19th century not to protect the rights of atheists, okay, but to protect against sectarian awards, uniquely, narrowly targeted religious aid from the government to a particular sect. And, you know, there's 800 years of history that says we don't really want to have that happen. But so let me unpack this a little bit. Montana's state constitution, Article 10, Section 6, has what is called a no aid clause. And like three dozen states have these kinds of clauses, right? This is not Montana leading the way on progressive, you know, right. This is just 37
states. I don't
know
that Montana leads the way on anything.
Oh, we're going to get emails again. We love Montana. We love our Montana listeners. And we seriously do love this provision of the Montana State Constitution, which says aid prohibited to sectarian schools. The government, and it defines all the sub branches, right? The legislature, counties, cities, towns, school districts, and public corporations shall not make any direct or indirect appropriation of any money of any kind, or grant any lands or any other property for any sectarian purpose, or to aid any church, school, academy, seminary, college, university, or other literary or scientific institution controlled in whole or in part by any church, sect, or denomination. Right? Super duper clear. And again, I want to point out in this litigation that's what the people of the state of Montana voted to put in their constitution. This case, if it goes the other way, and there's a huge risk that it will say you can't do that. We'll say if the residents of a state, of any state, no matter how liberal, no matter how conservative, get together and go, you know what, like, we got Catholics, we got Protestants, we got Mormons, we got Hindus, we got Jews, we got all these different religious groups. And you know what? The way in which we want to be fair is to say we just don't want to give out money to religious institutions. Not because we hate religious people, but because
it's sort of like a truce. Like, let's not have this battle where we each try to like get control of government and pay ourselves. Let's
just exactly right.
Stay out of it.
And what is at stake is whether it is not whether you have to do that, right? But whether it is even permissible for people to do.
Yeah, wow.
Here's how the conflict sets up. And again, I'm going to link, obviously, the scholarship in the show notes. I'm going to link the underlying court briefs, and we're going to talk about it a little bit here. So, 2015, Montana created a kind of quasi-voucher program, right? And that was called Senate Bill 410. It's now passed into the Montana code as 15-30-3101 and following. That did two things. And you can see, even in the two things, like the way in which the legislature is like, look, we know we're treading on thin ice here, so we're going to try and tiptoe around the fact that what we want to do is we want to give tax money to private religious institutions to instruct students in religious education. That's not a thing you should be able to do at the Supreme Court. So here's what Montana did. Montana first had a fundraising section, okay? And that fundraising section was a tax credit program that said, hey, if you donate to outside charitable organizations that provide educational scholarships, right? Those are called SSOs in the statute, or student scholarship organizations. We will donate you we will give back to you a dollar for dollar tax credit. Okay. And let me explain why that's significant, right? If I donate money to a nonprofit organization, like I do to the Freedom From Religion Foundation, for example, I get to deduct that from my taxes, but so the value of that deduction is whatever my marginal tax rate is, right? So somewhere between 30 and 40 cents on the dollar. This is a one for one tax credit. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's only up to $150, right? So that's part of the counter argument is, oh, really? You know, but this is for the funding of the slush fund. Right. So SSO gets tax dollars. It's a charitable organization, but this unique charitable organization is getting essentially, it's worth three times the bang for your buck to give money to the SSOs. Then part two, the SSOs can then use those donations to fund scholarships to any qualified education provider. And again, you know, you hide behind let me not mischaracterize. Legislation is written this way, right? Lawyers talk this way. But, you know, you now have a tax credit to an individual donation to an SSO. The SSO funds a QEP, right? And lots of people are just sort of, you know,
their eyes glaze over and because they're not document addicts like some of us.
Yeah, like at least 50% of this podcast. So the SSOs take their slush fund and they give out scholarships to any QEP, a qualified education provider, which was defined to include, and again, this is from the cert petition, essentially all private schools in Montana. SSOs pay the scholarship directly to the private school, right? So kind of a version of the modest needs model that, you know, we flogged last month for Vulgarity for Charity. The SSO says, hey, we want to sponsor Thomas Smith into, you know, the Cottonwood Christian Academy, and you let him in and we'll pay all of his tuition, and we'll pay his tuition.
Definitely something government money. Should be doing. Yeah. Sounds yeah. great.
That we raised with not just tax money, not just tax exempt, but we raised with a tax credit, a dollar for dollar tax credit. Second part. So first, the SSO pays directly to the school. And second, neither the donor nor the SSO could restrict the scholarships to any particular school. In other words, wow. The SSOs could not, once a school was on the list and all the schools were on the list, they could not say, oh, well, yeah, but we're not giving it out to Cottonwood Christian Academy, which teaches that the earth is 6,000 years old. So that's the law. It passed the Montana State Legislature. It then went to the Montana Department of Revenue to craft rules that were to guide the implementation of the law, right? This is the administrative state that's getting dismantled, thanks to Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. The law says, right, in order to pass constitutional muster, the tax credit, quote, must be administered in compliance with Article 10, Section 6 of the Montana Constitution, right? So you have this fundamental tension, right, because the law says, hey, administer this in a way that is consistent with our Constitution, but by the way, do the opposite of what our Constitution says. And so the Montana Department of Revenue tried to figure this out, and they created Rule 1. So I guess they don't have a lot of these to figure out. But Rule 1 was the implementing rules, right? It says that a QEP, a qualified education provider, notwithstanding being on the list, may not be, quote, a church, school, academy, seminary, college, university, literary or scientific institution, or any other sectarian institution owned or controlled in whole or in part by any church, religious sect, or denomination. So you see what they did there is, right, they just took the language from the law and they inserted word for word the language from the Constitution. It was like, hey, sure, create the slush fund, give out scholarships, but you can't give the scholarships to an explicitly sectarian institution controlled in whole or in part by a church, right?
Yeah.
And they did that because that's what the state constitution requires. So parents sued the affirmatively filed for injunctive relief to block Rule 1 from going into effect. And by the way, again, remember, like, that's the procedural posture of most of these cases now in the post-Trump world, right? We are not talking about the God's Not Dead of God's Not Dead 2 of these poor families are getting sued by this overbearing guy. No, these are people bringing plaintiffs' lawsuits, trying to block implementing legislation and the rules from going into effect so that they can get tax dollars to send their kid to a religious school. Because of reasons, they won at the trial court level. The trial court issued an injunction and blocked Rule 1 from going into effect. It has not yet gone into effect. That made it up to the Montana Supreme Court, and the Montana Supreme Court said, Are you kidding me? Right. They said, look, we have a constitution. The constitution says you can't give tax dollars to churches. This bill. We take it out of the left pocket. We put it in the right pocket. We take it out of the right pocket. We put it in Ken Ham's pocket. But still. Right. It doesn't say via how many steps. Right. It very clearly is unconstitutional. And moreover, the Montana Supreme Court said, and by the way, like, Rule 1's great and all, but like the underlying purpose of this bill was to give money to sectarian institutions. We're just going to find the whole statute unconstitutional, right? There's no way to save the statute via this implementing legislation. This is the Montana Supreme Court interpreting the state constitution of Montana about matters of issue concerning legislation in Montana, yeah, about people who live in Montana. So case closed, right?
Right. Yeah. What the heck? That's what I would think based on, that one weird trick episode about abortion. How does that interact here? This is a state issue. The state Supreme Court, is it that the U.S. Supreme Court can say that it violates the U.S. Constitution to even have this rule? Is that what it is?
I'm giving you another half point credit on T3BE. That's exactly right. So the argument, and this is why I walked everyone through this, is going to give all of our listeners who are applying for the scholarship, I think, a leg up. The argument before the Supreme Court is Article 10, Section 6 of the Montana State Constitution violates the First Amendment. You can't have it. It is asking the Supreme Court to invalidate a 150-year-old provision in the Montana state constitution, wow, as violating a newly created understanding of the First Amendment Bill of Rights. And if you're thinking, I thought that conservatives were supposed to be pro-federalist, like they've even got that in their society name, and like states are laboratories of democracy, well, go F yourself. don't put that in your essay. That's my free piece
legal
of advice.
Response, yeah. Yeah.
I want to say this. I'm going to include all of the resources from this show in our show notes, which include our three-part You Be the Supreme Court, episodes 14, 17, and 18, in which we looked at the Trinity Lutheran decision, and I confidently predicted that the court would go the other way. Our two episodes, Breaking Down Once I Was Wrong, the Trinity Lutheran decision, episodes 82 and 85. This is the major takeaway I want you to have in mind, which is in that You Be the Supreme Court, the case that I used to convince you that the Supreme Court was rather easily going to rule the opposite of how they did, right? That is, against Trinity Lutheran and in favor of the Missouri provision, was a case called Locke versus Davey, right? Which is an Oregon case that upheld a state restriction under a state constitutional provision that prevented you from using general scholarship funds to get a degree in worshipful theology, right? And basically said, the states can say, yeah, look, we're going to make funds available for education, but we're going to restrict out and go, but there's a more general principle here of we're not going to spend tax dollars on explicitly sectarian stuff. That case was called Locke v. Davey. I thought it plainly controls. It plainly does control, right? Trinity Lutheran is inconsistent with Locke v. Davey. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court was like, yeah, we don't want to hear about that. We're creating a brand new right of churches to compete for public funds out of whole cloth. And again, we went through that at great length, episodes 82 and 85. The two pages in which Anthony Kennedy creates the Trinity Lutheran test have zero citations in them. He just made it up.
Cool.
The reason I am emphasizing this is that the respondent's brief here, the state of Montana defending its policy, is based upon Locke versus Davey, right? And look, again, it's a good argument, and they're right. But this Supreme Court has already said we don't care about Locke versus Davey. And I can see a Brett Kavanaugh looking out and saying, yeah, counsel, you've said this is inconsistent with Locke versus Davey. Suppose, as a hypothetical,
what
this
part
court
of
says,
we're religious conservatives who don't care about what the law was, don't you understand, counsel?
Well, the way you phrase it is you say, assume for the sake of argument that we believe the Trinity Lutheran implicitly overruled Locke v. Davey. What do you say now? Do you have another argument? My
argument was, please vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, that's not a great Brett Kavanaugh argument. But yeah, so it is really, really important that we participate in this discussion, because it seems plain to me that that Montana is correct, and it seems plain to me that we are on a collision course for the Supreme Court to invalidate a core feature in a super majority of state constitutions. So you have a chance to win some money and also do some real good. So that's why I'm flogging it.
All right. Good luck. Cite us in your essay. It's a
oh, it's definitely. A good way.
Yeah. No. Write a real essay. Win the prize. And if you win, contact us and we'll talk to you about it at some point, whenever that is.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. Do a little breakdown of it or something.
Yeah. Also,
good luck,
everybody. Your Patreon amount, if that happens.
Yeah. Well, we want our cut. Clearly, we were a factor. No. I want a cut of your scholarship to law school or whatever.
Hey, you could use that.
I'm going to use, part of it to go buy some books or something. No, everybody, good luck with that. That's really cool. And also, that case sounds horrifying. I can't believe that it's not just a case closed. And what kind of world are we living in, Andrew? This is what we have to expect for the next, 30, 40 years, because the Supreme Court's been ruined? Pretty much going to be this for...
Yeah. Look, we're going to continue to give, coping strategies and how to fight holding holding actions. But that's actually not a bad preview for Tuesday's episode, in which we're going to talk about just how bad the Supreme Court is.
Oh, great. All right. Well, on that depressing note, let's do something much less depressing, much more fun, which is to thank our patrons, our new patrons here on First Timer Friday over on patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying all the goodies, the accidental early answers that come out before the question's even asked. And also, by the way, Lot Awful Movies coming at you very soon. Lot Awful Movies Christmas edition. We're trying to find a good Christmas law movie that... I mean, we have a candidate, but it's so bad. I'm hoping.
Oh, it's so bad. I want to do it.
But I also want to do something people have heard of. And this is just we'll see. Anyway, Christmas edition. Can't wait. So hop on to patreon.com/law. And I'd like to thank our new patrons, starting with Callum Plews, Austin Nagy, House Myth, Victor Treflack, Michael Marietta, Eric, Ryan Enk, and Mike Moyer. Thank you, folks, so much for signing on. Your turn, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you to Jens Flock. I don't know if that's meant to be a possessive or if that's a Scandinavian name, but Jens Flock, Michael Phillips, Bleeblap, Melissa Holdren, Rurard McIntyre. I'm sorry. I think that's a Scottish name, but yeah, you know, so it's probably pronounced Smith, but Rurard, I appreciate it. Regular size Dan. Well, okay, you know, I love that. It's good to be, you know, honest about ourselves. And Kevin O'Reilly, thank you all so much for supporting the show.
That's someone who works in an office with like a Big Dan or something. Hey, Big Dan. And they're the second Dan. And they're like, I'm just regular sized Dan.
I am so sick of being called Little Dan around.
Yeah,
here.
I'm
5'11". Come on.
All right. Thanks, new patrons. And now it's time for T3BE. Thomas takes the bar and answers the wrong question out of two every time. Narrows it down to two, expertly narrows it down to two, and then gets it wrong. What's that acronym or whatever? What's that abbreviation?
Yeah. Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Let's go. Here we go. I'm going to get right back on the right track here. I'm going to not do that. Although, side note, I might probably just do that again. What's the question?
All right, Thomas. Before putting her home up for sale, a homeowner painted the living room ceiling to conceal major water damage caused by a leaking roof that had not yet been repaired. On the first day the home was offered for sale, the homeowner gave the buyer a personal tour. The homeowner made no statements at all regarding the water damage or the roof. Without discovering the water damage or the leaking roof, and without consulting a lawyer, the buyer immediately agreed in writing to buy the home for $200,000. Yeah, I feel like there's a little bit of editorializing going on in this question here. Before the closing date, the buyer discovered the water damage and the leaking roof. Ah. The cost of the repair was estimated at $22,000. The buyer refused to go through with the purchase. Hmm. If the homeowner sues the buyer for breach of contract, is the homeowner likely to prevail? A, no, because no contract was formed since the buyer did not have a real opportunity to understand the essential terms of the contract.
Hmm.
B, no, because the homeowner concealed evidence of the water damage and the leaking roof. C, yes, because the homeowner made no affirmative statements of facts about the water damage or the leaking roof. Or D, yes, because the buyer acted unreasonably by failing to employ an inspector to conduct an independent inspection of the home.
Interesting. From my homeowning experience, I maybe this is a California thing, but I thought the inspection was mandatory. I didn't think you could even, I'm pretty sure you can't do it without the inspection. Or maybe if you buy in cash, like maybe it's part of the bank mortgage part. Maybe that's why you have to do it. Oh, okay. So we'll just assume that's not the case. Interesting. Tough one. I think a little less tough than the last one. So hopefully I can get it right, but we'll see. All right. Essential facts are it's curious. Okay. So I'll go through what I think are the critical facts. They painted the living room ceiling. It does say to conceal major water damage. I think that's pretty important, but it is true according to, you know, answer C, they didn't make any statements regarding the water damage. So they didn't say like definitely. No. And now, as you see here, this room doesn't have any water damage. Definitely taking a tour of the, would you like to see this definitely not water damaged ceiling? They didn't do that. So could be something there. Without discovering the water damage or the leaking roof and without consulting a lawyer, I don't really know why that factors in this case. The buyer immediately agreed in writing to buy the home before the closing date. One thing I struggle with is I don't really understand the significance of closing dates. That's been a problem in past questions. Like, do they have a contract or what's the closing date? Does the closing date mean they don't have it? Maybe I should just look that up sometime. That would help me out. Anyway, cost of repair, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So the homeowner is suing the buyer for backing out. The buyer discovers the water damage and that's going to cost $22,000 and is like, backing out. A, no, because no contract was formed since the buyer did not have a real opportunity to understand the essential terms of the contract. That's like a plausible-esque answer, but I actually don't really think that's it. Did not have a real opportunity to understand the essential terms. I don't know. Something about, I don't like it. I don't like A. It's plausible-ish sounding, but I don't think that's quite describing what's happening here. B, no, because the homeowner concealed evidence of the water damage in the leaking roof. That's a strong contender. That's straightforward. They did conceal evidence. That's in the fact pattern of the question. So that's definitely B is on the list. C, yes, because the homeowner made no affirmative statements of fact about the water damage. That's like, I'm like 60% on that one. It's possible. I'm not in love with it, but I could see that being the key. If they didn't make any, yeah, I don't know, but I think just painting to conceal, which it says, homeowner painted the living room ceiling to conceal water damage. I think that's already enough. It seems like to me, just to my instincts here, regardless of whether or not they said like definitely no water damage in here, or D, yes, because the buyer acted unreasonably by failing to employ an inspector or to conduct an independent inspection of the home. This is tough because I'm in terms of my narrowing it down, I'm like B is definitely a possibility. So that's on the list. And C and D, I find kind of equally almost possible. Like, I don't know, maybe I would put D as slightly more plausible than C. So if I'm going with my final two, it's B and D. Yes, because the buyer acted unreasonably by failing to employ an inspector. I mean, that could be it. It could be the case that, you know, you get to do a tour of the house and it's up to you whether or not you have an inspection done. You decide not to do that. You know, it's like, all right, well, you kind of got into this mess and it's your fault. I could see D being possible. But I do also think that if you're giving a tour and you've done something to conceal damage, I got to think that's enough to be able to get out of the deal. So assuming I'm anywhere close on my analysis between of B and D being the most plausible, which who knows, could be A or C, but I'm going to go with B. It's the straightforward answer. And, you know, we've seen on this new test book or whatever that's been the right answer. It's also been the wrong answer. So no idea either way. But this is one of those times where I think, yeah, you concealed the evidence. That should be enough to let the person get out of the contract. So B, final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right, folks. Thanks so much for listening. We will see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.